We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The United States is facing its worst unemployment crisis in decades, with almost 16 million people out of work and over 9 million people working part-time because they can't find the full-time jobs that they want and need. This morning in this hour, we'll be talking with Ross Eisenbray. He's the vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, based in Washington, D.C. And we'll be talking generally about the issue of unemployment, but also specifically about a plan that the Institute is proposing that they say would create millions of jobs. Among other things, it calls for strengthening the safety net, increasing federal support for state and local governments, and renewing investments in transportation and schools. If you'd like to read it in some detail, you can go to the website of the Economic Policy Institute and do that. And as we talk here this morning on the program, your questions will be welcome. We do ask people to be brief as possible so we can accommodate as many callers as possible and to try and be on target with the topic. But if you can do that, calls are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. His areas of expertise include labor and employment law and occupational safety and health. He is a lawyer, former commissioner of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. Before he joined the Economic Policy Institute, he worked for many years as a staff attorney in the U.S. House. He was legislative director for Representative William Ford. He also was committee counsel in the Senate. He served as policy director of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration from 1999 until 2001. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Eisenbray, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Maybe we can talk a little bit more, put this in these numbers that I gave at the beginning, the 16 million Americans out of work, and there are also a lot of people who are not working full-time who would want to be working full-time if they could find good jobs. Maybe you can you put that in some kind of historical perspective for us?
Well, it's the we've had the worst job loss in percentage terms in our history since the Great Depression. So 8 million jobs have been lost, and then on top of that, we have millions of additional people who are, as you say, working part time who would want to work full time, but can't find jobs. The unemployment rate was actually a little higher in the early 1980s at the start of the Reagan administration, but the job loss here is much greater. It started from a better economy, and the employment overall is just bigger anyway. So this is really the worst job loss, worst total job loss that we've had since the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm. And it's not it has different effects, or the numbers are different depending on what category of people that you look at. And I guess the thing I'm getting at is that it's the figures overall are not good, but if you look specifically at African Americans and Latinos, that it's even worse.
That's right. It's 10% overall. It's more than 13% for Hispanics, and even worse for African Americans. It also depends. The unemployment rate overall is worse for people who don't have a college education, but for people with a college education, this is the worst unemployment rate that we've recorded. Worse even than in the 1980s. It's almost well over 6%, heading towards 7%. So it's bad for everybody in communities of color where unemployment generally is nearly twice what it is for whites. Of course, it's worse, and we just published something about what's happening among American Indians, where unemployment is generally high and once again has just skyrocketed. So it's a terrible problem everywhere, and for minorities, it's even worse.
Yeah, and that I know, again, I guess I want to mention the website because I know that, for example, the thing that you just mentioned, Native Americans, that's there, and a lot of other information about the kind of things we're talking about, people can read about that if they go to your website.
Yes, at www.epi.org.
Yeah. And we lately have been told that here and there are signs that you can, if you want to grab onto something, that things have started to improve somewhat. There are those kinds of signs. At the same time, I think that your estimates and probably estimates of a lot of other people are that things, we're not really expecting this to change very much. And in fact, you're projecting that unemployment will keep going up into next year, and that unemployment, you're expecting it still to be quite high, even by the end of 2011.
The terrible news is that we had, at the start of this year, we were losing jobs in the economy at the rate of 600,000-700,000 jobs a month. And that has slowed way, way, way down, so that in the last month's report, we lost only 11,000 jobs, which, we're almost back to the point where we could be creating jobs. But even if we do, the unemployment rate will continue to rise, and that's because of several things. One is just the normal population growth, and, in the spring, we'll have people entering the workforce who haven't been in the workforce before, graduating either from high school or college. So there's a normal growth in the population. We have fewer old people who are retiring right now because their stocks were hit, their retirement income is uncertain or greatly reduced. So they're staying in the job market and not freeing up jobs that would otherwise open up. There are on top of that, about 2.5 million people who have withdrawn from the labor force and are not counted among the unemployed. So when they come back into the labor force and start competing for the available jobs, unemployment is likely to rise because of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the thing that is the most serious problem is that even as we stop losing jobs, we're just not creating them very fast. And, in fact, we're at the lowest rate of job creation that we've had in 50 years. It's just really it's a terrible combination right now. And the sort of net result of all of this is that we have more than 6 unemployed people looking for work for every available job.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a situation where no matter how hard millions and millions of people try, they're not going to be able to find work.
I want to make sure, we go on and talk about what you think we might do about this, but I guess if you'll forgive me for continuing to be really negative here, one wonders how many of the jobs that have been lost will actually ever be recovered. And I'm sure that there are some employers that if the economy improves, that they will hire people back. But one wonders, to what extent we have seen here a contraction in the economy that will, if not be permanent, will be very long term. And then we're talking about even effects lasting out, we talked about continued high unemployment in 2011, effects that would last even farther out into the future than that.
Well, if we don't do things differently from how we've been doing them, you're exactly right. There are jobs that are lost. Certainly there are jobs that are lost from businesses that have gone out of business that will never come back. But looking at it, sort of macroeconomically, we've lost millions of jobs in manufacturing. And if we don't change our national trade policies and our policy toward China, those jobs are gone forever. They could come back, but it would take doing something about Chinese currency manipulation. It would take changing tax policies to encourage our manufacturers to manufacture in the United States rather than abroad, and different trade policies to protect our market against countries and foreign corporations that undersell and dump goods on our market. We have laws that, if they were enforced strongly, would protect jobs and actually help return work to the United States. But the single biggest problem is that ever since China joined the WTO in 2000, we have lost 2 million jobs just to China. 2 million, good middle-class jobs in manufacturing industries just to China alone.
The federal government has put some significant resources into trying to stimulate the economy, and this is the thing formerly known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It was a lot of money that went to states and local governments. How helpful was that?
Well, it was very helpful. The economy, as measured by gross domestic product, grew in the third quarter of this year and wouldn't have grown if it hadn't been for the Recovery Act investments. So that growth accounts for about 1.5 million jobs that would otherwise not be in the economy right now. So unemployment would be at least a full point worse than it is now if it weren't for the Recovery Act. And those investments are actually peaking right about now. There's a lot of transportation infrastructure investment coming online, and a lot of jobs could be created. On the other hand, the Recovery Act was faulty in the fact that one of the most important things that it did in terms of both helping people maintain their homes and just helping them make ends meet and stimulating the economy was all of the safety net programs that were expanded, and most importantly, unemployment insurance, which is now the maximum that one can get is 99 weeks. A jobless person can receive a total of 99 weeks of unemployment insurance. That's about to be cut off. At the end of December, that program will snap back to 26 weeks of unemployment insurance, and millions of people will lose unemployment benefits, and that will be very, very damaging to the economy.
Mm-hmm. Surely that is something that the Congress has to be aware of and has to have in mind. Is there any possibility? Are they talking about renewing that extension of benefits?
Well, they ought to be. This is actually the first part of our job plan is
right.
Renewing
uh-huh.
those benefits for a full year. They're talking right now about renewing them for 2 months because they just can't get agreement on what to do. So 2 months is better than nothing. It will keep those millions of people I just mentioned from falling off the unemployment rolls, and will help people who are now about to exhaust their regular state benefits to get these additional federal benefits. But, it makes no sense at all to do this just for 2 months. At the end of February, we'll hit this cliff again. And, there are 6 million people right now who have been unemployed for more than 6 months. This is the longest. When you were asking to put the current jobs crisis into context. We have long-term unemployment in a way that we haven't had since the Great Depression. I mean, we've never had this many millions and millions of people who have been unemployed looking for work for more than 6 months, and they just can't find a job.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ross Eisenberry. He's the vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. It's based in Washington, D.C. We're talking here this morning about unemployment in the United States and also some of the ideas that they put forth in a plan to create jobs, a plan that they say would create at least 4.6 million jobs in the first year and cost about $400 billion. And we'll talk a little bit more about their plan and how they think it could be paid for. One set of ideas for job creation. And again, if you'd like to read more about this issue in some depth, you can go to the website of the Institute, the Economic Policy Institute, which is epi.org, and you can read all about it. Here on the program, questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We're getting some callers lined up. Let's start talking with someone in Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to start my question with just a short little history of where we're at here. Over here in Vermilion County, which is an east central Illinois county, very agricultural, one of the larger counties in the state of Illinois. Back after the Civil War, they put a lot of railroads through here. Things boomed real good all the way through the 50s. Man, it was a big community, going fast, and lots of factories. Early 70s, things started turning down. A lot of factories started leaving. A lot of General Electric went to Mexico. One factory after another, large lift truck manufacturer left for other places. Now we have a community that was built for about a 60,000-person community is now about 30,000. So Chicago decides to do some improvements in urban improvements, and they suggest to a lot of people to take their Section 8 dollars and go someplace where there's available housing. They came here, bringing a multitude of problems into a small community by the name of Danville. And I'm sure people have looked at this community because it's so unique in how difficult times have been. We have been at 12% unemployment now for maybe 15, 20 years. And the country is now catching up with us. And a lot of these jobs that have left have gone because manufacturers and investors and stuff want to get the largest return on their dollar. So they ship the jobs to someplace else, wherever it might be less. Now, that's bad enough, and we could possibly change that with rules. But the other problem that people don't realize in this economy that's going on is that when an employer improves his business by putting in CNC machines, finding better ways to produce his product more efficiently, he needs fewer jobs. So therefore, the jobs that were there and did leave, fewer are going to come back because the employer doesn't need that many people to produce his product. So the question I have to you, how in the world can a community that is already beset with problems possibly think about making a turnaround?
Well, Mr. Eisenberry, you got some thoughts?
Yeah. The caller is certainly right that one of the things that's going on in the economy is that higher productivity, you know, using better production techniques to produce more with fewer people, is happening every day, and it's the goal of almost every employer. So, in fact, right now, as the economy grew in the last quarter, productivity increased at a really astonishing rate at about 9.5%, which means that the same number of workers was producing 9.5% more. Now, that can't go on forever. I mean, you just can't work people. This wasn't so much the result of additional business investment. It was really getting people to work harder and produce more from the sweat of their brow in large part. But that's also how the nation creates more wealth. If the 150 million people in our workforce produce 9.5% more next year, the whole nation would be that much wealthier. So that's a good thing. Where do the jobs come from? Well, that additional wealth gets reinvested into the community. Right now, business is not doing that investing. They're not going to be creating very many jobs in Vermilion County. Something else has to be done to do that. And the answer is the government. that when the private sector isn't producing jobs, we have to turn to the government, and it can be the same kind of thing that he mentioned. In the 19th century, it was railroads. The 21st century, it can be railroads again. We could have mass transit. We could have, highway projects that are done I don't know anything really about Vermilion County, so I don't know what shape your roads are in. We have bridges that are falling apart all across America that could be replaced. Lots of people could be put to work rebuilding our infrastructure. I don't know what your waterways are like there, but it doesn't take too much imagination to think about New Orleans and what needs to be done there to replace the dikes and the water control systems. We have sewer systems all across America that still discharge tremendous amounts of human waste into our water supply, into our rivers and lakes. All of those investments would put a lot of people to work, and I think that's the first place that people in Vermilion County ought to be looking.
Can I interject one other thing, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Over this long period of time that we've had very poor economic times here, many of those things have already been done in this community. We have a waterworks that's fabulous. We have water supply that's sufficient for much larger things because people have already done that. But unfortunately, for some reason, America doesn't want to bring work back into America. And we have to bring work to the common man because that's what's going to support the entire economy. No matter how wealthy the world may get because of our increased improvements, if the individual doesn't have a job, he can't spend money on any product that's being made.
Well, and that's exactly why the Obama administration is calling for a massive investment and making massive investments in green energy. We can create millions of jobs here in the United States, exactly the kind of job you're talking about, by substituting for imported oil energy that we create here at home, manufactured energy from things like wind turbines and geothermal energy, solar energy. If we manufacture the turbines and the solar panels and all of the equipment that's needed to produce that energy here, we create a lot of jobs. We help with our balance of payments problem. It helps national security. It solves a lot of problems.
We are already at a midpoint here. I have some other callers I want to get to, and I want to thank the last caller. Also, for anybody who has just tuned in, I should introduce again our guest, Ross Eisenberry. He's the vice president of the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C. He's a lawyer, former commissioner of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission, also worked as a staff attorney in the U.S. House of Representatives, also as committee counsel in the Senate. And we're talking about the problem of job loss and the need for job creation. And again, I want to mention that if you're interested in the kind of plan that the folks there at the Institute, the Economic Policy Institute, have laid out, you can go to their website, which is epi.org, and take a look at it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go on here next. Talk with someone in Champaign on our line one. Hello.
Yes, you're doing really important work, by the way. I was reading. I regularly read Paul Krugman's blog at the New York Times, which is very, very insightful. But he's noted. He describes what he calls a minimal definition of success for job growth, in which, for example, within 5 years. To return us to more or less full employment, that would be, of course, 7 years of depressed employment, as he notes. And he says to keep up with population growth over those 7 years, the U.S. would have to add 84 times 127,000, I think that's the number per month you mentioned in your report, or 10.668 million jobs. He says add in the need to make up lost ground and we're at around 18 million jobs over the next 5 years, 300,000 jobs a month. And that's a useful benchmark. Even if we add, as he says, 300,000 jobs a month, we're looking at a prolonged period of suffering, a huge cost from the Great Recession. So as he puts it, that's kind of a minimal definition of success, 300,000 jobs a month. And I wish, that people would pay attention to what you're saying and what Krugman is saying and speak directly to the inflation and debt fetishizers in our Congress, including many Democrats, and Obama himself talks about inflation as a concern and so forth, which is just laughable, and Krugman is just flabbergasted that anyone would talk about inflation right now. We're, I think, at the lowest since the 1940s, and so it's really shocking, but I wish you'd speak to that, the macroeconomic importance of doing something about the job situation and why that's what we really need to be concerned about right now.
Okay, I'd be happy to. You're right, and Paul Krugman has been probably the clearest, brightest thinker on these subjects, and he really has been terrific. His point is that if we don't deal with the jobs crisis, we'll never get out of the recession. Obviously.
Right.
On top of that, we won't fix the deficit problem that we have, which is the biggest contributor to the deficit right now is the fact that we don't have people working. We don't have people paying taxes because they've lost their income. And on top of that, we have to be sending money to them in terms of unemployment insurance, food stamps, health care coverage through COBRA. The balance is running in the wrong direction right now. So if we put millions of people back to work, the deficit problem begins to resolve itself. If we don't, we can't solve it. People look at the deficit and there are people who use it as a tool against government intervention, and there are others who probably are well-meaning. And actually believe that we're saddling our children and grandchildren with debt in a way that's not appropriate. If we don't attack this the jobs deficit problem, we do so much long-term damage to the economy that we do much more harm to our children and grandchildren than by spending what we need to do to put people back to work right now. Borrowing costs are actually very low. It's a great deal to make the investments in green energy, in public infrastructure, in direct job creation right now, rather than having an economy that's working at 70% of capacity and generating much less wealth than we can and ought to be doing. So the trade-off is clearly in favor of intervening now, putting people to work, and doing things that are important in their communities, putting them to work, doing productive things, not make work, that actually has the added benefit of providing enough consumer spending power.
You're from a very
right now to allow businesses then to have the customers that they need to make the investments, they otherwise won't make. The entire economy depends on having consumers who have enough money in their wallets to go out and buy things.
My sense is, have you ever been interviewed, let's say, with Krugman? At least he's on ABC. But have you ever been interviewed on any of the major networks about these issues?
Other people in our institute have, yes.
Oh, that's good. Okay, because I don't sense that the mass media in general, that you may be getting one-fourth of their time, but three-fourths of their time seems to go to people who are worried about the inflationary issues and the deficit more than anything.
We're a tiny little institute with a budget between $6 and $7 million. There's an institute, the Peterson Foundation, has a $1 billion budget to raise deficit fears and kind of scaremonger, to try to get people to do really exactly the wrong thing. For example, I said earlier that Congress can't be persuaded right now to extend these unemployment programs for the year. It makes no sense at all to let people fall off this cliff, and we'll have families losing their homes. We'll have consumer buying power hugely depressed will have terrible consequences for families all across America. And yet deficit fears right now are keeping Congress from doing, you know, what's plainly needed.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I want to go on and got somebody here who's on a cell phone, so I want to try and get to them on line two. Hello.
Hi. So I guess my question is, a few months ago, there was a lot of public outrage about Bank of America paying $5 billion in bonuses of taxpayer money while basically failing. And the outrage about the fact that it's taxpayer money is quite understandable. I share it. But another thing that kind of kills me is that money is like the reward for massive failure. And if you break that down into jobs, that's like 60,000-70,000 jobs, I think, at $60,000 to $70,000, you know, with decent benefits. And so we kind of ask ourselves, well, where are all the jobs going? It's like, to me, it looks like a huge part of the problem is not just they're being shipped overseas, but that productivity or not, even failure, is rewarded with huge rewards for a very few number of people, whether they succeed or not. And if you took every company that was following this model, that maybe you might find millions of jobs hidden away there. And I don't know if there's a government way to solve this. I've heard maybe mentioned even on this station something about a tax structure that, you know, makes it harder tax-wise to pay a salary or bonuses that are so hugely excessive compared to, like, the lowest paid employees. And just what are your thoughts on solutions to that? Or maybe I'm misperceiving the problem, and that's all. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
No, I agree completely with the caller that our financial system has – the financial sector of our economy has driven the economy into this terrible recession. It was the giant asset bubble in housing that was driven by, you know, really fraudulent practices in mortgage banking, giving people loans that they couldn't afford, that the mortgage banking industry knew they couldn't afford, packaging these mortgages into essentially fraudulent investment vehicles, telling people that they were AAA rated when in fact they were almost the equivalent of junk bonds, and on and on and on. It led to tremendous profits for the financial services industry, and huge bonuses that they collected. And through the 2000s, we got to the point that about 40% of corporate profit was being earned by the financial sector, which is, you know, crazy. The financial sector is supposed to be raising money to support Main Street, to support manufacturing, to support the productive economy. Instead, it was really siphoning off money and leading to outrageous bonuses and pay practices that have caused a tremendous inequality in America that we didn't used to have. We used to be a nation where a rising tide really did lift all boats, and we're not there today. So fixing that problem, I think, will be very important to a sound economic future. And one way to get there is by taxing these transactions that really have no public purpose, that are actually socially destructive. So, the churning in the financial sector and people making a profit on every trade they make and having, you know, thousands and thousands of trades instantaneously that are being done by computers, generating profits on every one of them, taxing those transactions to slow that process down and to keep the profit from being made on all of them would be a good thing. It would also generate a lot of revenue for the government, and it's part of the plan that we've proposed is to have a financial transaction tax, a Wall Street sales tax, or what others have called a speculation tax, that would generate enough money to more than pay for the jobs that we need in the short term, and actually provide a cushion for the out years, 8-10 years from now.
And that is the your main, as I read it, that's your main method for paying for the job creation plan that you're putting out there.
Yeah, right. In the congressional 10-year budget window, this kind of a financial transaction tax at a half percent of the value of the financial assets being traded or sold could generate as much as $150 billion a year.
Just real quick, and I promise I've got other callers, real quick to come back to a point that the first caller made, and this is something that over the years when we've had conversations like this seems to have come up again and again when it comes to the loss of jobs and manufacturers, particularly manufacturers, increasing their profits by reducing their production costs by shipping jobs overseas. People have said, you know, there's something we should be doing about this. That is, there should be some government-enforced disincentives, something that could discourage manufacturers from doing that. Now, it could be that to a large extent, this is the horses are out of the barn. But is that, you think, something that could be done or should be done?
Well, a lot of what's happening is that companies in the United States are producing now, are producing their goods in China. And why are they doing that? Why would a chemical company that used to be in Illinois move to China to do its production there? Well, obviously, labor is very cheap. Why is that? Partly it's because unions are suppressed. If you're not in the government-sponsored union, it's illegal to be in a union in China. And that has a real effect on wages and the benefits of Chinese workers. They have energy subsidies that would be that are illegal in international agreements, but they're well documented that China does them, and so that's a boon to a manufacturer who goes there. The Chinese currency is pegged at an artificially low rate, so that if you produce in China, the cost of producing in U.S. dollars is very low. And when they sell back into the U.S. market, it gives them an advantage, a manufacturer an advantage of 30 to 40%. That is something that the Chinese have said when they entered the WTO, they said they wouldn't do. They've done it for all of the 9 years since then, and the U.S. government has done nothing about it. Fixing that problem, that one problem alone, would make it possible for manufacturers here to compete and for businesses to start up here rather than in China. If we don't do anything about it, we will continue to see manufacturing jobs bleed overseas, to China and elsewhere in Asia, where other countries follow China's lead.
Well, let's take some more of the calls. We'll go to Champaign, line 3, for the next person. Hello.
Line 3?
Yes.
Yes, this is Dan. It occurs to me that, like, what you're talking about is what are some of the classic criticisms of capitalism, which is, like, it doesn't want to run at full employment because it needs to keep about 10% of the population in the very lowest class, just as a way of keeping in power. Then I was wondering also the fact that capital of the financial sector, as you say, call it, I mean, that's isn't one of its nature, as you mentioned, transnational.
Your caller is kind of breaking up on us, and I don't know if we've got enough of a question here that we can deal with. It sounds like essentially what the caller wants to do is take issue with capitalism and say that's the problem.
Well, unregulated capitalism can be a problem, but I'm not really sure what the caller said, so it's hard to respond.
Well, my apologies, really. Yeah, I don't think we got enough of the caller to do anything with that. We do have other callers, though, so we'll go on. We'll go to Urbana Line 1. Hello. There a caller there, Urbana? Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Okay, I wanted to, I've heard some talk about the National Infrastructure Bank as a proposal to help put some capital availability for small business who, you know, generally drives the economy. And I was wondering if you'd given any thought to that idea and how that would compare to, you know, providing a lot more funding to the states.
Well, I don't think the National Infrastructure Bank is really the way to do that, since small business doesn't generally invest in the big kind of infrastructure projects that the bank should be involved in, you know, like a nationwide rail project or, you know, huge airport improvement projects and things like that. That's not really the realm of small business, but there are proposals to use TARP money that is not being used for the financial bailout anymore. It isn't needed for that purpose, to make it available to small businesses who haven't been able to borrow from commercial banks. I think that is a good idea. I think there's no question that there would be more job creation right now if small businesses that have a good market were able to make investments. Their cash flow problems right now are serious enough that it's working against them. They might be laying off workers, even though there's enough demand for their product and services that with borrowing they could.
Yeah, I think that's been the problem. Add. You know, a small business can't get the credit it needs, and so there was talk about creating a bank that would, you know, have to abide by the rules that the government has set down, you know, in terms of how much compensation their CEOs can take.
Well, you know, in the Recovery Act, there was money made available, and it was essentially loan guarantees that a bank could loan money, let's say $100,000 to a small business, and have 90% of that loan guaranteed by the federal government. But it's not clear. The Small Business Administration says that actually has helped create 300,000 or 400,000 jobs, I think. And if that's true, then clearly we should be doing more of that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. We have maybe 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Ross Eisenberg. He's the vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. It's based in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the problem of unemployment and job creation. This is something Institute deals with in their American Jobs Plan. If you'd like to read about that and a lot of other kinds of information, available on the website of the EPI, Economic Policy Institute. So if you have net internet access, you can go there and you can read about the jobs plan and other things. It's www.epi.org. We have some other callers here. Next, we will go to Champaign and line 3. Hello. They're calling there, line 3 in Champaign?
Line 3, yes.
Yes.
I want to commend you on the work that the EPI is doing. I'm familiar with it. And the earlier caller mentioned getting the word out, and I think he is quite right. if there's too much attention to the deficit at a time when we still are not out of the recession, and if there's no deficit, there's no stimulus. My question relates to one missing element only in what it is you're saying, and that is the attention to protectionist measures inevitably leads to reaction by the other countries to say that we're going to do this, that, and the other, and then China won't retaliate is just not realistic. There's long history with this, and including going back into the Great Depression, moving to protectionist measures, which reduce economic growth and slow the recovery. And why has there been so little attention to the huge skill deficit, the investment that could be made to increase enrollments in, let's say, community colleges in the U.S., the 30 job, 30 occupations in which the job increases are the greatest and projected to be for the next 15 years, according to the BLS, are all, with one exception, industry occupations that require a two-year degree or a four-year degree. And in now what is happening is tuitions are going up and young people are being driven out of these community colleges and four-year institutions. And I've tried to reach Jared Bernstein on this. His email is not accessible. And I wonder what you would say to that.
I think that what I said, let me start by just saying what I said about China was not actually protectionist. I think that having fair rules that where all countries and the businesses that operate them in them are treated the same is what we want. And, you know, I'm not saying that we should treat China differently from anyone else. Germany has a huge export market, but they don't peg their currency to ours, and they don't have an artificially undervalued currency. They're managing to do well, even as the euro increases in value against the dollar. So I think China should be treated as any other country, and they just need to play fairly by international rules, and they haven't been. So with respect to education, it's true that in percentage terms that the occupations that will grow are projected to be ones that have the most education. It's unfortunately not true that's the case in numbers, in sheer numbers. Most of the largest job growth that BLS expects, the Bureau of Labor Statistics expects, is in jobs where all you need is on-the-job training or a high school education. So this is not to say that education isn't hugely important. It is, and you're exactly right, that it's getting harder, not easier, for students to get an education, a college education. California is increasing tuitions in the state university 32% over the next 2 years. You know, obviously that's going to drive hundreds of thousands of people away who otherwise could get an education that they need. So I think you're right. We need to make it more available, not less available, but we shouldn't think that giving everyone a college education solves our employment problems. It's not enough. It's important, but it's not sufficient.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. In absolute numbers, however, most of these are people who are replacements as people retire. These large occupations that have people that are less skilled, as they retire, then their jobs open up. So in terms of just replacing people who are retiring, yes, you're right. But in terms of where the comparative advantage of the United States lies, it lies in our human capital. That is where, in the long run, we can really compete in the world. And the enrollments have been flat since about 1991. All of Europe, all of OECD, they're all coming up like gangbusters. And the United States is lagging way behind and falling very seriously behind. And it's no wonder that exports suffer.
Well, we could do a lot more. It's true in terms of research and development spending, in terms of supporting our students in the sciences, giving them stipends to make it possible for them to earn advanced degrees. I agree with you completely about that.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to try to get at least one more caller. We'll go to Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. China is not just China. China is multinational. I agree with your points, but I think there's a way of misinterpreting it to be very nativist. I mean, a sixth of the carbon dioxide emitted by China is actually, for their export market, and a lot of it's from Motorola and Caterpillar and manufacturers GM that are actually multinational. So I think we need a little more nuanced approach to talking about this international trade, because a lot of it's internal trade within corporations itself. So, I'm not taking away from your general point that the, but it benefits, you know, the aforementioned multinationals to have the system the way it is to some extent. And the Tobin tax, or whatever you want to call it, I think Brazil has instituted it, and it really ought to be done at an international level, and ought to be funding climate amelioration, and it should be on the docket at Copenhagen. But I don't know how you'll integrate that in, but I do like your report at the EPI website.
All right. Well,
Thank you very much.
We're kind of coming down to about the last minute or so. You can comment on what the caller had to say, or if there's another sort of thing you'd like to mention here just at the end, you could do that.
Well, I would like to mention a couple of elements in the jobs plan. When I said that we should strengthen the safety net and continue the unemployment insurance program, I didn't say that we calculate that the spending that produces, the re-spending in the economy in local communities, amounts to about enough to create 900,000 jobs. That if we, in other words, if we don't extend those benefits, the unemployment insurance and the COBRA health subsidy for another year, we'll lose 900,000 jobs that we would otherwise have. If we don't provide fiscal relief to state and local governments, which are facing serious budget shortfalls, we could lose another 1 to 1.5 million jobs. When they have to balance their budgets, if they have to raise taxes or cut spending, it's not just the firefighters and the teachers and police officers who are laid off immediately, but the reduced spending power in those communities affects private businesses. Half of the jobs that would be lost in private businesses. So it's critical that we provide fiscal relief to state and local governments. We calculate that we could create 250,000 jobs in the coming year just repairing schools that have deferred repair and maintenance. We have 1.5 million construction workers who are unemployed right now. We could put 250,000 of them to work all across the country in the 16,000 school districts,
yeah,
doing things from roof replacement and repair to replacing old windows and fixing boilers or even just simply repainting classrooms. So.
Pardon me for jumping in on you. We're just going to have to stop because we're here at the end of our time. Again, though, if folks would like to read more about the American Jobs Plan of the Economic Policy Institute, go to their website, which is www.epi.org. Our guest in this hour of the program, Ross Eisenbury, is vice president of the Institute. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, David.